Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday, the 19th of September. Very nice to have you with us, and we welcome you all to the proceedings. We have a wonderful group of individuals who will share their thoughts and question some of the things that's happening in our daily politic. Whatever the hell it is. We will also welcome you to the discussion. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we'd love to hear from you. Let me introduce the group to you, investigative reporter and professor at University at Albany, Rosemary Armeo. Good morning.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you here. Stuart Rice, Honorary Chair of the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences, CICS, among friends, and Faculty Associate of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. And I will just add, one of the nicer people in the world, Fran Berman. Hello, how are you?
God, that's such a great introduction. Thank you.
It's wonderful to have you here. Thank you very much.
I'm happy to be here.
Former Times Union Associate Editor and confirmed nicest person in the world.
Oh, my God. I'm the only bad person here. Wow. I know my role. I know my place. I'm happy with it.
I was going to say, if I called you the nicest person,
I wouldn't like
so
it.
Mad.
I know. I'd bite your head off.
Mike Spain, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. And thank you for that very gracious introduction. And Fran, we're in a club together, right?
We're in a club, but you're the president. And I have to say, I think Rosemary is the spiciest person in the world.
So I prefer that.
Will you accept that?
Yes, I accept that. Thank you.
Done. I'll take spicy. Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to our program. A little sugar, a little spice. You know, it'll be fine. It'll be a good show overall. We have a lot to talk about this morning, and again, we welcome you, panel at wamc.org, panel at wamc.org. Let us go to our first topic, and that is, there's a couple of places that we could go. President Biden is at the UN and faces a tough sell in extending support for Ukraine. Perhaps we should begin there as being the timeliest of the stories that we're negotiating this morning. The Russia-Ukraine war's toll on food and energy prices has accelerated calls in the developing world for a negotiated settlement. And this is now, we look at the president going to the UN. There was a really powerful, I thought, powerful interview with Scott Pelley on CBS Sunday night on 60 Minutes, on the season premiere of 60 Minutes, about with Scott Pelley and Vladimir Zelensky about the U.S.'s role, and an interview that was done last Thursday and interviewed on and aired on Sunday. So where do you think we are, Mike Spain, as President Biden goes to the UN and faces this tough sell?
Well, that's exactly what it is, evidently. The difficulty now is that, as many of the news reports and the analyses have pointed out, Zelensky had hoped to come to New York with some wins under his belt, some significant progress in the war to push back Russian forces in Ukraine. And that hasn't gone as well. And it has left many of the countries that have continued to support Ukraine and many people in the U.S. Congress and the public in the United States wondering whether we should continue to bankroll this effort to help Ukraine push back Russia, and whether that's a worthwhile expenditure and whether it's going to succeed and where it goes from here. And people are weary of the impact of war. And so Biden has to go and try to, use his bully pulpit, I guess, from standing in front of that green wall at the UN and try to get our allies to step up one more time while he's still having that same conversation with some people in our own Congress that the U.S. should step up and continue to support Ukraine. The hope is that Zelensky, who can be very effective, will he himself is going to address the UN, that he'll be able to be compelling and convincing, and they'll get the necessary support, because Russia is probably banking on the erosion, and as long as the war goes on and it's indecisive, the Western countries will begin to wither in their support, and that looks like it's happening, and Zelensky has the opportunity today to correct that.
Well, what Mike said, except I don't think Zelensky, star that he is and star power that he has, is going to be able to pull this off. I think that you've seen a click, exactly as Vladimir Putin predicted, that the West was just tired of it. If they didn't think the West did not think Ukraine had a chance at the beginning, then their hopes got up, but it wasn't miraculous. It didn't happen overnight. And so now it's like back to boredom, back to nationalistic policies, you know, America first. I think that things look very bleak for him and for the chances for Ukraine.
Fran Berman.
You know, Zelensky is the great persuader, and I just think he's done an incredible job of drumming up support for this for all over the world. But to me, this is a giant game of international chess, and there is a lot of moving parts for each of the country, the countries, you know, that could support it. You know, we have to they have to figure out what the right combination of dollars and resources and restrictions are that help promote one side or another. And at the heart of it, I wonder, you know, what are the Russian pain points and the Ukrainian pride points that need to be capitalized on to thread the needle for some sort of peaceful resolution? And I just think that strategy is really hard, and it usurps the great and very compelling advocate that Zelensky is, and it has a lot to do with each country's particular political structure. You know, you're hearing a lot of countries saying, countries in Africa, countries all around the world saying, you know, this is really hitting us where we live in not a good way. But for these folks to get to the table, for Russia and Ukraine to get to the table, you know, there's got to be some strategy that makes it, you know, essentially beneficial. And I'm not sure what that is. And I think that's right. I think we do have and I say this out of the great privilege of not being in the middle of a war. We have war fatigue. And I do think that Russia is trying to capitalize on that. But it's sad. And, you know, what can Biden accomplish? I don't know. It's a big game of international chess. You know, he's a guy with a lot of sense, although not as compelling as Zelensky. He has his own problems in our country. So I don't know. Sometimes I look at these things and I think, you know, this is great theater, but what is really going to happen? And I think what really happens is all of those backroom conversations where they try to figure out these strategies.
There was a moment in that interview during on CBS with Zelensky, as I said, Zelensky and Scott Pelley, and Zelensky made the case about that Russia's attitude right now is basically waiting for there to be great tumult in the United States, and of course that would be the reelection of Donald Trump, and just sort of waiting that out. But
although it's already happening. You've got a Congress that is moving not so slowly and surely towards enough. We've paid enough for Ukraine.
Right.
And the tumult just could come as soon as 2 weeks. I think I don't see any movement towards a budget or a continuance while they figure out a budget. It's the government could be shut down soon. What happens then?
And even if there is a short-term continuance, the plan on the table right now does not include any additional funds for Ukraine.
Absolutely. Yeah, the Republicans have not proposed that. And then let's look at the state of our military, which thanks to Tommy Tuberville is a mess, not set to respond to the continuing chaos in Europe. And the economy, I think, is going I'll get notes from people saying I'm definitely not an expert, but I don't see the economy getting stronger in the fall when you have prices on oil going up thanks to obstinacy by Saudi Arabia mostly. And I don't see food prices improving with the wheat situation in Eastern Europe.
We touched on this. I think we touched on this, too, but it's not exactly like Zelensky and Biden are a united front either.
Right. That's true.
I mean, there's a lot of back and forth between the two of them. Zelensky seems to be.
I mean, realistically, what can we expect in terms of what the U.S. itself is willing to put up? I mean, do we have any sense of that? Is that all the way from zero to, you know, I don't know, what we're putting up now or more?
Well, they're trying to. The administration is trying to get one big package that includes, a continuation of the funding, with the possible expectation that it may be our last big one, you know. And the Senate, at least, is supporting the administration on that in a bipartisan way. Even Mitch McConnell and his caucus are supporting it. Most Democrat and Republican senators want to continue to fund Ukraine's efforts to stop Russia. But the weakness, of course, and I guess we're going to talk about it, is all part of the collapsing budget talks going on in the House of Representatives with the right wing, a small right wing group of members of the House of Representatives holding it all hostage and digging in on any kinds of expenditures that include Ukraine.
Right.
When you look at what we can expect from the president today, which I believe happens before the meeting, right? They have he speaks, and then he meets with Zelensky. Of what he says to, nothing obviously will appease his political opponents in this country, but when it comes with our allies across the globe.
Well, Biden is trying to build on the notion that we're back in the game. The U.S. is back participating in the broader, welfare of the entire world. You know, we're back where we were before Trump tried to dissolve NATO and pull out of NATO, and when Trump was, cozying up to Putin. You know, that's no longer the case, and he's going to emphasize that. But everybody, you know, just as Zelensky made the, sort of overt reference to, everybody is aware of the politics going on in the United States, and they know that every 4 years it can flip like that. And that is something that everybody is watching. So while they may give us, certainly lip service that they're supporting Biden and this unity is really important, they're watching very, very closely about what's going on in the 2024 presidential race.
Aren't we all? All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'd love to hear from you. Rosemary Armeo, Fran Berman, and Mike Spain making up our group this morning. And again, we welcome your thoughts at panel at WAMC.org. We will return after this short break and news from the BBC. Thank you. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion, listening to the music of Tinsley Ellis this morning. We have the playlist posted online at wamc.org/roundtable, wamc.org/roundtable. We would love to hear from you. Gene writes to us and says the GOP is largely funded by Russian oligarchs that they repeat Putin's talking points and they share a nationalist worldview concerning so-called traditional values. We know Putin, and we know Putin meddled in our elections and supported Trump. The war in Ukraine is about so much more than just Ukraine. If you peel back the layers, it's about democracy versus nationalism. It's not war fatigue so much as Russian boosterism pretending to be about frugality.
Just a fact check there. Is the GOP mostly funded by Russian oligarchs? I'm not so sure that that will hold up. There may be some influence,
check.
But I think there's plenty of American oligarchs that are funding the GOP. Mercer family, others, you know.
Great point. Yeah. Joanne writes, it's hard to discuss the war without including Elon Musk's relationship with Vladimir Putin. When Musk can turn Starlink on and off, it doesn't help Ukraine's ability to succeed. That from
I think that's a really important point, because I think these days, of course, we have these multinational companies, especially in tech, but, you know, also in energy and all kinds of things in, you know, pharma, et cetera. And their relationship with the government is close. And it's an important relationship. Think about COVID and the relationship between the government and the pharmaceutical companies. Think about the relationship between tech, Elon Musk, you know, turning the internet on and off. You know, is one thing, but there's very deep relationships there. And so now in your cast of characters, you really have to include another group of people. And those are these very important heads of companies and their relationships with the government. So I think that's a subtlety that it's, really is part of this.
You're calling it a relationship, Fran, but what actually is happening is the government, Republicans, are ceding functions of government. They're privatizing them. They're giving it – there is no relationship. It's Elon Musk who has the satellite network, not the U.S. government, and that is what's putting it at risk. We shouldn't
be
doing
that. Sometimes privatization works and sometimes it doesn't. You know, think about
for
the
national,
airlines, for example.
But for national security measures?
Well, I mean that's an excellent point, Rosemary, and the question is, how close of a relationship for each specific thing do we need to have, and what kind of controls do we want to have on each of them, both the private sector and the government? And I think that plays out in different ways. I mean, I think the airlines are, you know, not perfect, but a reasonable example of, you know, how we've done these things. Sometimes you want the government doing things. I mean, in my own opinion, we should have the government doing more tech than it does. Mm-hmm. First of all, it needs the tech expertise. Second of all, if you think about, you know, imagine having public-focused tech capability. I mean, we have that in television, right? C-SPAN is pretty boring, but it provides a way of information that the government does. Think about public radio. You know, we don't have a public internet. And, you know, we have a private internet that we have some relationship with. And all of the applications on that internet are by big companies in the private sector.
So
there's lots of things we can do in this combination of public and private that's more in the public interest.
So let me ask an impossible question to you, Fran. It is mean that I even ask this question, but I have to ask it, which is so
you don't get to be in the nice person club. I'm just saying that. If you ask this question,
you're out.
You've come to the dark side.
We're throwing you out.
I'm not putting you, I think, on the spot. I just think for all of us to help us wade through it, there's a major new book out by Walter Isaacson about Elon Musk that is making news and gives us several more tidbits into the background of this man and his motives. But I'm interested in when it comes to issues like major things like our relationship with Russia and the war in Ukraine of what we should make of Elon Musk and what we should make of X. As for its power, we also hear this morning that it may be going behind a paywall. What does that mean? What do we make of that, of this figure in the tech world who is really having an outsized role in what is happening, at least this week?
Well, okay, we're keeping you in the nice person club because that is not a mean question. That's a really excellent question. And I do think that we have had we no longer have sort of a separation of commerce and state or a separation of tech and state. We don't have that. I mean, if you think about who are the world leaders, you know, Elon Musk is kind of a world leader. Bill Gates is kind of a world leader. You know, there are all of these people who have these multinational companies, and what they do in their company has a big influence on what we do in the public sector, what we can do, and all of that. And without restriction to them, you know, it's problematic. And of course, no one can prevent Elon Musk from talking to anyone he wants outside of the United States. That's our rules. We, you know, you get to talk to it. But some of those conversations really do have an impact on our national security. And for him to just operate rogue, whether he's operating for good or for bad, you know, whether he's a jerk, which many people, including me, believe, or whether he's not, you know, just the whole setup that he can go rogue and kind of have these discussions that impacts our national decisions and our national security, that's problematic. And I think it is the power of folks in the private sector as well as the power of folks in the public sector that we don't have that separation anymore. And I do think that it's important for us to kind of put the structure in place so that those conversations are more appropriate.
There's also that Trump-esque quality that he possesses of what he says Monday is not what he says Tuesday, which then contradicts what he said on Monday and Tuesday.
Yep. Yeah. I think that's true.
Yeah, that's apparently true with a lot of people. I mean, it's no longer necessary to worry about what you said in the past. You can just make that inoperative and say something new now, and that's the current message.
I agree with you, but when the past was 2 days ago, you know, I understand if we're talking about something that you said in 1978, but
the guy is a private citizen. He gets to change his mind every picosecond if he wants, and he gets to change his company, which is, he can get to change that every picosecond if he wants.
Can I interrupt? Yeah. Fran, what is a picosecond?
Oh, God. Now I have to remember, I can't Google it really fast. So I think it's either 10 to the minus 17th or maybe it's 10 to the minus,
minus 12 or 1.
Oh, thank you.
1 trillionth.
Yeah. A trillionth of
thank
a second?
Yes, as a unit of
so
time in the international system of units.
Is maybe 10 to the minus 17th. I'm not sure about that.
Abbreviated as PS.
I just wanted to hear you say it. Thank you.
We're definitely not in picosections seconds now.
it's very, very tiny. He can change his mind as often as he likes. And in fact, changing your mind is a good thing. When I was a kid, I didn't like liver. You know, I think liver's just fine now. So, not all
that
liver.
Is not a good thing to flip-flop on.
I mean, I think, you know, one can change one's mind. I mean, that's called growth and evolution. But, you know, when the impact of you changing your mind has this kind of national influence, you know, that's crazy.
Let's go to go to a couple of the letters here before we take a break in just a moment. Joan writes, Biden's aid has been too little, too slow, too late. I will never forgive Biden for eking out aid piecemeal to Ukraine as Zelensky begged for more air power and defense from Russian missiles. I am an independent but always vote for Democrats, but I can't stand Biden as too little, too slow, too late is descriptive of most of his actions. His term is almost up, and now he tries to act with less lethargy.
Yeah, so vote for Trump. It'll be much better. He acts fast.
Mm. You know, I actually can... I can relate to some of that, you know, but Biden doesn't get to just make these decisions all by himself. I mean, he's in this incredibly straitjacketed system that gives him only so much latitude. So within that system, he can be too slow or too late or whatever. But, you know, the system doesn't let him go very far. And that system includes Congress and, you know, other priorities and all kinds of things.
Claire writes, can Elon Musk get in big trouble for interfering with foreign policy? Is that not treason? We go to...
Yeah, I kind of wondered about that when we were talking myself. You know, at what point does this really constitute a danger to the national security of the United States, which you don't get to do? And how would we know? You know, I think that's a really good comment.
Gene writes to us and says, last night I watched Superpower, Sean Penn's documentary about Ukraine. It was eye-opening and on the ground journal of citizens' pain and destruction through interviews. I wish our Congress would see it as well as every citizen concerned about autocracy. Zelensky has the ability to cut through the BS and say what is needed succinctly and with honesty and passion. I wish him well today. Then we go to Christopher. In my humble opinion, the best thing for everyone would be for Joe Biden to declare he's not a candidate for the Democratic nomination. Why are we not hearing this suggested publicly?
Are you kidding? It's been everywhere, including an editorial in the Washington Post. It's been every freaking way.
It's our next story up for bids, by the way. It's the front page of at least two major newspapers today, so I think we will talk about it, obviously. Is anyone organizing a write-in campaign? I would suggest Gretchen Whitmer, but it would be good if those of us expecting to vote for a write-in candidate could mostly agree on a person. And finally, why can't a limited number of House Democrats, perhaps those elected from mostly red areas, vote with Republicans to pass a budget and strip the far right wing of their power to hold proceedings and McCarthy hostage?
Yeah, that's a really good question, except that voting with Democrats is seen as more anathema than shutting down the government.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll move on to other topics. We welcome you. Fran Berman, Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo make up our panel. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Take us to break, Mike Bowen. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Rosemary Armeo is here, Fran Berman and Mike Spain. I'm Joe Donahue, and we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let us continue and move on to another big story, which... So if you're following this at home, and I know you are, late Sunday night, a group of Republican lawmakers, House members in GOP House members, a relatively small group came together and said, oh, we have a plan. We have an agreement on the budget. And they said, oh, great. And then immediately everyone said, well, we don't think it's going to pass the House. It certainly isn't going to pass the Senate. But isn't it nice that 7, 8, 9 people got together and agreed on something in Washington? And that is
that's
impressive.
Called unity. That's
that
called
is unity. It's unity. You know, it was between football games. It happened. It was all good. Well, now the House Speaker on Monday came out and said, this is something that we can work with. This is something that we can move forward with. And we have the votes. Republican leaders were hoping to pass the combination of spending cuts and border controls to show they were working to forestall a shutdown and pressure the Senate, but the bill's prospects look grim. That is the story in this morning's New York Times. Speaker Kevin McCarthy's bid to gain the upper hand in a battle over federal spending hit stiff opposition from within its own ranks on Monday, leaving him with dwindling options and little time to find his way out of a funding impasse that could lead to a government shutdown in less than 2 weeks. Roughly a dozen Republicans made it clear that they were staunchly opposed to the proposal, unveiled on Sunday, which combines a stopgap spending measure with steep funding cuts and new border controls, indicating they could not be induced to change their votes through leadership pressure. The measure had little chance of passing the Democratic-controlled Senate, but Mr. McCarthy, who has made it clear he is desperate to avoid a politically damaging showdown, had promised it as a way to pressure the other chamber to come his way on spending. I will quickly note that that particular agreement brought us to the end of October.
Yeah.
So
it worked. Nothing.
It was a spending plan for a month.
A month.
Yep.
For whatever that's worth. Yet the internal resistance made it clear that he is well short of the votes to pass it. So unlike the mean question that I asked Fran Berman a moment ago, Rosemary.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you a softball where I'll sort of answer it within the question. But is Kevin McCarthy obviously he could not have thought this was going to work, or do you think maybe he did? I mean, this couldn't have come as a surprise.
Well, I think he was trying to copy his success with the also doomed bill from nowhere that he got through the House, a few months ago when they were considering
the debt limit.
Yeah. And that worked because it did show that, okay, the House had something. It changed the dynamic of what was happening in the Senate. He obviously was going for that again. But he is up against that small, willful, uncaring about any citizens, only themselves, minority of far righters who don't like him. And they're wise to him, so they didn't let the tactic work this time. I think he's doomed. I think he's going to be booted out. I think we should be having discussions about, okay, who's the next speaker and what kind of trouble are we in when that happens?
One of the three Johns, right?
I think so. I think it would be Scalise, actually. I think Scalise will just
Steve
move
Scalise.
In. Yeah.
Even though
he's
ill.
Rosemary, I have to admit that even more than Ukraine fatigue, which I don't have that much Ukraine fatigue, I have McCarthy fatigue. I am so tired of watching this sort of government by bullies scenario happen over and over again. You know, I almost think, don't quote me, that ChatGPT should be running the government. Honestly, with all of the hallucinations, you know, maybe ChatGPT could do a better job. I mean, it just seems to me a person who spends, you know, every single day thinking about the public interest and what we can do to promote it, that we're in this situation where we have these two very polarized parties, and we have at least one party who's basically directed by a handful of bullies, that the majority of people think are just out there and who don't seem to care about anything in the public interest. And, you know, like, how do we avoid doing this again and again? One of the things that I was thinking about is, you know, this whole system around debt and the budget is kind of broken. And I remember, and I was trying to remember the details, and I don't, but maybe somebody out there does. Other countries don't do it this way. Other countries don't have this kind of regular circus
This has come up every few months whenever we're in a new debt crisis. And the problem is that there's nobody, because there's nobody in place who will change the system. It's like the Electoral College. We know that's outdated, too. But who's going to fix it? We're putting people into Congress who don't want to fix it. They are not representing us. And, I mean, unlike you, I am endlessly fascinated by the machinations of a man who has no moral compass whatever. He is so powerful and completely powerless. He is in the hands of those bullies. I find it's like a Greek drama. The guy's gotten exactly what he wanted. He had the hubris to think he could bring the separate parts of the party together, and he's stewing in it. It's fascinating to watch.
You go back to when I think the 9th or 10th round, they were voting for him, and he's just sitting there and he's looking around like, come on, guys, let's just get this over with. And it was clear that they're just playing with him, and it didn't.
It was humiliating. It should have been.
It should have been. That's exactly right. It should have been humiliating, and it wasn't.
Yeah. No.
But it's like watching a cat play with a cat toy.
Yep.
I mean,
another thing I can watch for hours.
Yeah, that's cute.
It.
Yeah.
At least that's entertaining. It's painful to watch what's going on. Every single day, Kevin McCarthy gets up and probably just tries to plot his way through the day so he gets up again tomorrow and is still speaker. And it's getting more and more difficult. It's almost like orchestrated chaos. There is no other option here, right?
Right.
So I think I agree with Rosemary that it doesn't seem like he's going to make it. And that becomes more and more obvious day after day. Does it happen before there is some kind of some sort of agreement, whether it be temporary or not, or will it come after that?
I think that the bullies are going to push us into a government default, and it'll happen then. They'll emerge then with the news. That's a prediction, but it could just as easily, you know, Matt Gaetz could get up this afternoon from a nap and say, okay, here's what we're going to do instead. I think that there's increased frustration by the so-called moderates, if there is such a thing in the Republican Party anymore in the House. But again, that would require them to align with the Democrats to save the country. And I don't see that happening.
Yeah, that's hard to imagine.
It's hard to imagine.
Because
I've been thinking about that scenario, and I think, I mean, that would be fascinating. That would, you know, that for me would keep me on the edge of my chair. But
a combination.
I can't imagine the Democrats allowing it because, you know, in some sense, you know, they're polarized too.
I'm going to reject any kind of comparison of Democrats and Republicans in the House. The Democrats are sitting back right now, letting this drama within and dissension within the Republicans play out, which is exactly what they should be doing.
Oh, look, they're walking in with matches and gasoline.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Isn't this fun? But if they said, okay, we have to save the country, we're going to take care of it, there's nothing they can do. They do not have the votes.
Right, but it is important to remember that Hakeem Jeffries, the minority leader in the House of Representatives, has been able to keep solid his conference, and when they need to vote in unison, he's able to get that, and that's something that McCarthy cannot get. So if even a small majority of the Republicans would compromise, you could get something through with
absolutely
the help of the Democrats. Of course, I don't think there are many moderates left in the House of Representatives. And that's the sad in the Republican caucus in the House of Representatives. There are some, but they're afraid, you know, they're afraid to appear moderate because these
challenges
10 or 11,
from the right.
Yeah, they're afraid of challenges in primaries back home from the right. Even though they might be able to win the general election, they're worried about being primary. And this is a pattern that we've seen play out in the last 4 years. And right now, I think that's exactly what's going on. You said bring in the gasoline, bring in the matches, Joe. I mean, there is a small group of members of Congress whose solution to the problems in our government is to basically make it collapse and then rebuild it from the ashes. And that seems to be their goal. They'll let it just implode. And when the budget deadline, budget deadline comes at the end of September and there's no budget, the government will shut down. And it's going to be a painful period, not for them, but for everybody else.
We'll pause there. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll move on to other topics. We have letters as well. We welcome yours, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Rosemary Armeo, Fran Berman, and Mike Spain joining us this morning. We'll be back after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Investigative reporter and professor at Albany, University at Albany. You are a visiting professor at the University at Albany this semester. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Rosemary Armeo is here. Stuart Rice Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Science, CICS. And faculty associate at the Bergman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, Fran Berman is here, and former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain. We welcome you all. Just a quick reminder, the Roundtable Mug Contest is going on. So we have this 16-ounce stainless steel travel mug with a black rim on top. I used to have one in the studio, and then somebody stole it.
highly coveted mug.
It wasn't me.
I don't know. I don't know what happened. It didn't make it through the weekend. I had all the paperwork scrolled up inside of it, so it would make it, to me, sort of obvious that it was needed as the prop. Because, you know, I'm assuming everyone's listening to the show and know what's going on. Anyway, so
you know who you are. Just saying.
So there's this mug, and it has you can put a design on it and come up and this is not something that we're looking for. This is an amateur contest, but it's a contest for you, the listener, to decide what we give away for the fun drive. So we'll give this mug away as a fun drive premium during the roundtable, and we thought it would be lots of fun. There it is. Look at that.
Aha!
Thank you. It's back.
Was she the thief?
I don't know.
Oh.
The mug, it... I don't know. I think did you detect a door slam?
No. It was a very guilty person. Slunk out of here.
That was somebody stepping in. Amber Sickles brought it.
All right.
Brought
a
new one,
her.
Perhaps.
Yeah, perhaps it is a new one.
You put the logo on the front of the the design on the mug, and
sure.
And all you have to do is go to RT Mug Contest, wamc.org/RT Mug Contest, and you can come up with the with the design. And all you have to do is come up with it. You have until October 3rd. We're going to start the roundtable kickoff, or the lockbox kickoff, excuse me, on the 2nd of October. The fun drive begins on the 16th. And by that time, we'll have the mug all set and ready to go. So if you'd like to take part, wamc.org/RT Mug Contest. RT Mug Contest, and we'll see how it goes. I'm interested to see what people come up with.
Mm-hmm. Could be fun.
It could be fun indeed. So we will find out.
Arts and crafts for WAMC listeners. I love it.
That's right. It's an arts and crafts project for our listeners. When you're so bereft by the stories that we talk about, you can come up with a design for our mug. All right, so that is going on. And by the way, most importantly in all of this is that the lockbox will be opened officially on the 3rd, but you can, or on the 2nd rather, but certainly you can help in the meantime. WAMC.org. WAMC.org as the fun drive officially begins October 16th. Okay, let's go on to other topics. And work with what we've got here. We actually have some letters, so let's go to those first, and then we'll change. Hello, panel. As I understand it, it will be a partial shutdown. Certain functions will still be in place. Is my understanding correct?
Well, there always is, a basic set of functions developed. A lot of federal workers are in what they call, required jobs or must. Must be there, like FAA staff, military, et cetera. But what you get is a lot of regular government workers will be on furlough, and some government, what you rely on your government for, may be slowed or shut down temporarily. I suppose if you want to get a passport processed, or if you need to get some kind of a regulatory permit or something like that, those kinds of things will be delayed. And it will,
or if you want to go to a national park,
I mean,
there's a lot of things that can be shut down.
Social Security, that's the one I worry about.
Right, the end of the month, the Veterans Administration medical centers will stay open, but there may be cutbacks all over. Um, and And usually when there is a government shutdown, we've had state government shutdowns when, you know, usually that's what they do, Fran. They shut down the state parks, the services that people use the most and rely on.
To put pressure
on their elected officials to restore the funding.
Right.
So we go through these charades. I think the big one, the one that everybody talks about, and maybe it was the first real big one, was when Newt Gingrich was Speaker of the House, and it was a face-off between him and the Clinton administration. And I think that historians will say that Gingrich erred, and it really was something that bolstered Clinton afterwards.
And so did Trump when he let the government shut down and actually said, I did it. It has not worked out well for Republicans. So it's one more reason that makes you wonder what the bullies, the right-wing, the berserker conference, as Mark calls them, what do they have in mind with the government shutdown? It's just so obdurate.
Kathleen writes, the so-called moderate Republicans, an oxymoron, I'm looking at you, Molinaro and Lawler, could stop the hostage-taking by the truly crazies by refusing to align with them. The Dems and a few moderates could stop the shutdown in a flash.
That's a really fascinating thought. And you know, it came up during the time when they had, 13 votes to elect Kevin McCarthy as Speaker back in January. All you would need was a small coalition of moderate Republicans coming to negotiate with the Democratic leaders of the Democratic Conference, which hold a slight minority in the House, and they could run the show, and the country would be better for it, and it would force others to fall in line instead of letting 10 or 11 really extreme right-wing people hold our entire government hostage.
Let's go to Dave, who says, why is it that a government shutdown doesn't shut down the salary of Congress for its duration? Also,
no, it's a good idea. I mean, what's happening with the writer's strike, right? When with the writer's strike, you know, it shuts down a lot of things beyond the writers. I mean, think about the writer's strike and not just the impact on the writers, but the whole economy around the major studios in Southern California, you know, the little places where people get their coffee or get their, you know, costumes dry cleaned or, you know, whatever they do. And all of that economy has really suffered. And there's a lot of articles in both national and local papers in California about that. And there's a ripple effect. It's not just the people in the government that are not going to work. It's the people around them, the little, you know, the gas stations and the little stores and, you know, and all of these kinds of things where they have their goods and services done in the private sector. So the ripple effect is giant.
Let's move on to other topics here, as I promised when we came back from the break, and go to the story about Joe Biden prompting Democratic anxiety. And, well, we've certainly touched on this over the last
six
years, I was going to say, but yeah, sure. But this has become more and more. There was a David Ignatius opinion piece in the Washington Post that was one of a few, and now it's starting to become certainly, I think, was discussed well before that, but I think in major publications such as the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, that it becoming a news story as to this anxiety among Democrats and concern over the current president's age. And it's not helping matters that there are a lot of polls that are coming out showing that President Biden could lose or is very, very close to that of Donald Trump. That is those are numbers that at one point showed Biden winning in a theoretical matchup with the former president, Donald Trump. And now it shows him either very close or losing. A number of polls, growing number of polls, are showing voters concerned about President Biden's age and energy. Democratic lawmakers have hesitated to offer full-throated endorsements of his running mate. Prominent commentators have ruminated on whether he should drop out of the presidential race. This series of political vulnerabilities, along with House Republicans announcing an impeachment inquiry and the Justice Department indicting Biden's son on gun charges, is now sending waves of anxiety through parts of the Democratic Party as some fret about whether the man who helped oust Donald Trump from the White House may not have the vitality, at 80, to successfully prevent a return. He is in a period of his life where passing and death is imminent, said Sharon Sweda, the leader of the Democratic Party in Lorain County in Ohio, who said she often hears from voters worried about the president's potential frailty. We are all on a ticking clock, but when you're his age or at Trump's age, that clock is ticking a little bit faster, and that's a concern for voters. Many in the party continue to voice confidence in Biden, and they note that Biden himself is not much younger at 77, that Trump himself is not much younger at 77, but Biden's allies are frustrated by the hand-wringing from an anxious fraction of the party. And even as campaign officials point to the president's record of defying skeptics, they are strategizing internally about how to best combat the unmistakable nervousness. Rosemary?
Wow. Well, I think both candidates are too old, as I think many members of Congress, especially in the Senate, are too old. But I don't see how that gets fixed this season. It looks to me that barring some huge development that I can't foresee, Trump will be the Republican candidate. And for the Democrats to go against him, I love Gretchen Whitmer. I don't think she can win. I don't think women are going to beat him. I don't think anybody else has risen to the spot of Biden, who beat him before, has done nothing now to not deserve re-election except grow older, which he couldn't avoid. I don't see a way out of this now. And part of me wants to make, you know, Dave Ignatius and other writers say, shut up. Don't let him think about it. But it is very much on the forefront of people's minds. If it's Gavin Newsom, step up, you know, convince me. I'm not being convinced by any Democrat that they can take on the fight that Joe Biden has waged against Donald Trump, which is the reason I'm voting in this election.
Well, if I may.
So I've been thinking a lot about. Oh, go on.
No, okay. I'll quickly say it and then step aside. I really do wonder. I mean, this was a front page story in the Washington Post. Sunday had a very similar story in the New York Times. And it's all kind of a reaction to the many stories that have been written about how Fox News, other right-wing media, Republican organizations have put out tweets and clips of, or X's rather, and clips of, Biden stumbling, Biden mumbling something a little weird. And it all seems to be building up. And you just wonder if we're creating more anxiety than there legitimately should be. You know, what we need is more objective assessments of the president's health, and we seem to get them, but they seem to fall on deaf ears. And I think the Democrats are in a quandary of how to handle this. The people in Biden's campaign are hoping that once this all kind of plays out early next year, Biden versus Trump, all you have to do is point out all that Biden has achieved, and people will unite behind him because all you have to do is point out all that Trump stands for. And with moderates and independents and Democrats, that will take care of it. Democrats are worried that it'll soften voter turnout, and the result will be a re-election of Donald Trump. So it's a crazy dilemma. And it's interesting, too, if Biden were to acquiesce and step out of the picture and open it up for a primary. Lyndon Baines Johnson waited until the end of March of the year that he bowed out of the 1968 re-election. He was assumed as the candidate to run in 1968 for a full term against the Republican nominee at the time was Richard Nixon. And he waited till a few months before the Democratic convention to pull out. And
not a good move for the Democrats, well, it might have been, pointing out.
It might have worked out better had Sirhan not assassinated Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Robert F. Kennedy Sr. And, you know, that changed the course of history, and it's hard to know who would have been elected if Nixon ran against that Kennedy. He lost again against one. He'd probably lose against the other, but that's all history. All I'm saying is that it's never too late to speculate about what will happen in the coming election year. It is just too difficult to predict this kind of thing.
So I don't think I'm alone in this, and no matter, you know, whatever your party affiliation is, but right now, at this moment, at 10:24 on this Tuesday morning, the President of the United States is speaking before the United Nations. And I have not gotten over the fact, he's been president now for almost 3 years, I have not gotten over the fact that you're just sort of waiting. You hold your breath and you just think, oh God, is he going to get through this?
That's the job of his staff.
But the staff has been problematic. I mean, the staff has been shielding him.
There's an argument that they've shielded him so much they've made him look. He looked silly in Vietnam. Again, a press conference I watched, he was absolutely brilliant and on point, and they made him look doddering at the end because they wanted to get him off, and they're like,
they wanted to pull
the hook out of him.
Who is it that calls the shots that the president can't decide himself if he's going to continue to talk? And it doesn't look good. They're shielding him from the press.
And he says stuff all the time like, am I going on here?
Right.
Is that too long a story? He's definitely being coached. They should just let him be Joe Biden. He's
always said wacky things.
Yeah.
And you know, he was speaking recently, and at the end of the speech, he just said, you know, God save the Queen. You know, it's a complete non sequitur. But that is Joe Biden, and they're not letting him be Joe Biden.
Exactly.
And if he could be Joe Biden.
Okay, but be careful here. Yeah. Because, you know, people say, well, that's just Donald Trump. You know, he makes all these sexist, stupid comments. He doesn't really mean it. Boys will be boys, you know, so.
And that has worked, you know, perfectly great for Donald Trump. It has worked for Trump. So we're saying, do the same for
Trump,
Biden.
But, you know, remember, you want to apply the same criteria. I don't know. I never have a straight answer for you guys. You know, it's never like, oh, yes, or oh, no. You know, to me, I read this, and it's still another article on how Biden seems old and how lots of people are worried, including me, about that. And, you know, and Trump's old, too, but nobody seems to pay that much attention. And I started thinking about ageism, which ageism is rampant in our society. If you want to get a job in your 60s, God forbid in your 70s, forget about your 80s. It is not happening. It's not happening unless you're already the famous artist, the famous writer, the famous whomever. And so ageism is rampant. And, you know, why? Sometimes we have ageism for really good purposes and sometimes we don't. I find it very interesting that Biden seems old, but somehow Trump, who's, you know, a few years from him, doesn't. Ruth Bader Ginsburg seemed frail, but she didn't seem incapable. You know, she had lots of fans. And so there's this kind of perception versus reality on age. And there's also a capability versus incapability. You know, how much stamina does it take to do your job? And, you know, for my own opinion, I think that, you know, Pelosi should not be in Congress. McConnell is too old for Congress. You know, I think we should have a cutoff on who can be in Congress and who shouldn't. Maybe 80 is the right thing. I don't know what the right thing is. I think we should have a cutoff for president, too. I think that Biden, who is, in my opinion, is doing a really good job and somehow isn't sexy or marketable enough or guided enough or something to capitalize on that to the max. I think if we had somebody who was
younger, you know, at a different point in their career, that that would inject energy. And if I think, you know, for me, the ideal thing would be to have not Trump and not Biden, but two other people sort of inject a new kind of energy into that and kick out the old guys from Congress. Is that because I think they're not capable? I think sometimes age caps make sense. Sometimes ageism makes sense. And I think that the 24/7 nature of that job, the kind of representation we need and the stamina needed for those jobs make it very, very hard for, you know, really great people who are in their senior years to do them. So I have kind of mixed feelings about all of this. Given the current system, sure, Biden should run and he's doing a good job and I hope he gets elected and I hope he does a good job for another 4 years, and I intend to vote for him. but, you know, do I wish we had a different situation?
Yes.
I do wish we had a different situation. I wish we had a different structure where, you know, we kept the age and we actually allow new generations to be, you know, in public service, because new generations are needed.
We've got to,
for almost everyone to relate to.
We've got to go to a break, but I mean the other thing too. No, you're fine. The other thing,
I always talk too long.
The other thing I have to say is that, you know, this isn't going to go away. If Joe Biden wins in 2024, then what are we going to say on his 82nd birthday, and his 83rd birthday, his 84th birthday, his 85th birthday?
Can I just point out, China frequently has been run much more powerful and demanding position by old men, and they've not died in office in general, and they've been very competent. So I don't like the situation, but it's sure better than Trump. I'd rather have an old guy in than an old criminal, which is what Trump is.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue with our discussion. We'll move on to other topics, and we will welcome you into the discussion. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org. We'll finish up with Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, and Fran Berman when we come back after this news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. So let's stay with this age question for a few minutes, because we do have a lot of letters on it. And then we'll move on to other things and fill out our last segment with our terrific panel. Tell me exactly what Biden is not doing. He did show up to work, UN, travel, trips. Exactly what is he doing wrong, not enough of?
Good point. Look at
what he has done. Queen Elizabeth got to hang on until she died. And guess what? Get those young ones in there and they they will make mistakes because they do not know which world leaders to trust, how to get a bill passed, and when to pressure and when to chill. I love President Obama, but he was not perfect. He made a few mistakes, and that's from Maggie in Clifton Park. Then we go to Colleen, who says it's not about ageism. It's about, are you able to do the job of the United States president? He is not. He is not bagging your groceries.
Yeah, but one point I'd like to make.
I'm not sure what that means.
Well, it's a more important job than bagging groceries. Somebody who's 80 might be able to bag groceries, but can they be president? I suppose the writer said. But we all know people who seemed to lose their ability to focus and concentrate maybe in their 50s or 60s. And we all know, or 70s. And we all know people who were sharp, right on top of it, right until the end of their life, which may have been in the 90s or older. And you can't just apply one label to it. And there's science about all this. Fran, you should be telling us that. There's science about aging, and it can be measured.
Yeah, Fran.
I'll leave it at that.
I will tell you that unless in my own profession, as a data scientist, as a computer scientist, if I wanted to work in the private sector, now we'll get letters. If I wanted to work in the private sector in Silicon Valley, the only way I could do that is to be a venture capitalist with $1 billion. Nobody at my age, and I am less than 80,
just heads up. nobody at my age, and in particular, no woman at my age, is really getting hired, you know, for just about anything. I mean, computer science is rampant with ageism, and as is many other professions. And I get that, and I resent that, and I like to think that I am just as capable as many of my younger colleagues. That being said, you know, I do think that lots of professions have age caps for good reasons, for stamina reasons, you know. I can't imagine doing the job of president at any age. The kind of stamina you need, you have to be up 24/7, et cetera. And the body does age. Does that mean that there aren't people who can do great leadership jobs at any age? Of course. You know, look at Gandhi. You know, look at all these people. But I do think that also look at McConnell. And, you know, look at Pelosi and look at lots of people. So I don't know if we're playing the odds. I think it's OK to have an age cap in government. And I think it would actually refresh government. But I understand that that is not a popular point of view.
Let's see. David writes, I am in my 50s, so not old, but not young anymore either. Age should not be such an issue, but rather, can the person do the job well? I might be more concerned about an 80-year-old airline pilot. A political leader or business leader does not need to run marathons. They need wisdom and good judgment. We also go to Charles, who says, to raise enthusiasm among Biden voters, find a really good VP candidate and promote them like crazy. If it's going to be Kamala Harris, sell her hard. Then.
And that was a big mistake that they didn't showcase her right from the very beginning.
Right.
Well, they have made so many mistakes with Kamala Harris, and they did not give her the kind of guidance and mentorship one needs as a vice president to be able to take over. And they're still not putting her in the forefront.
That sounds so paternal to me. If the woman were capable and truly desired to be president, she wouldn't need a mentor or guidance. She would be demanding it and getting it. No, she's not strong.
Every single vice president, female or not, needs that kind of introduction to that kind of decision making and that kind of connections with other leaders.
Joe Biden made her the first woman, the first person of color in that position. He gave her an enormous stage, and she did not take advantage of it. He did not ignore her. Yeah, he ignored her after he gave her two huge portfolios, like deal with immigration, deal with problems that we have with elections. She started down the road, had a few fumbles, and then backed away. I'm sorry. I believe in support and mentoring, but not when we're talking about a vice president. That's a huge position. It's one step away. She could be president tomorrow if all the predictions about Biden's death, imminent death, come true. She's president tomorrow, and she's not ready? Sorry. No, that's on her.
I think she's not ready, and my beloved Rosemary, I think we disagree on this because I think they are both culpable. You know, I think she clearly needs to capitalize more on the opportunities available to her. I think she needs to have the right kinds of opportunities. And I think, you know, that part is on Biden's side of the table.
All right. We go to Parker, who says, yes, Fran. Yes, Fran. And young minds might have new strategies instead of the same old ways of doing things. Our government needs change. Perhaps AOC, that from Parker. Then we go to James, who says, remember the whole injecting bleach to fight COVID? How many speeches have gone off the rails with random rants, lack of cohesion that Trump had? It's sickening how the right has pigeonholed Biden into some decrepit old man. Having said that, regardless of politics, this country does not need to stop voting for old white men. We need fresh blood in our Congress and Senate and unique perspectives.
I agree.
Yeah, we all agree. And what's happening right now with all these old doddering fools in Congress is discouraging bright young minds from going into politics. So I see this in Eastern Europe, and it's happening here. Why would I go into that field? I'm not a crook. I don't want to have anything to do with politics. That's increasingly becoming common among our young people.
I think that's true, but I think more prevalently. I think if you want, I mean, I saw this when I lived in San Diego, a neighbor of ours who had been very active, you know, wanted to run for Congress. And the thing she had to do to actually get any kind of support, in her case, from the Democratic Party to run for which, and I'm sure it's no different from the Republicans, you know, to raise enough money and to like meet enough leaders and, you know, to do all the things. And, you know, I'd be happy to run for, you know, office before I'm 80, just saying. But, you know, I just can't imagine going through, and I would be happy to serve the public, not running for anything, folks. But I can't imagine going through, jumping through all the hoops you have to do to even get on the ballot and the support of anyone. I can't imagine that. I think that, you know, the fact that AOC did it was like amazing. The fact that anybody does it is amazing. I think it's really hard for sort of normal citizens who care about the public interest and have something to offer to actually participate in government as a job.
Well, being 55 years old, my attention is starting to wander, so let's change the topic and go to Jan Wenner.
My gosh.
Jan Wenner, the co-founder of Rolling Stone magazine, has been removed from the board of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Foundation, which, by the way, we should note he helped as founder. One day after an interview with him was published in the New York Times, in which he made comments that were widely criticized as sexist and racist. The foundation, which inducts artists into a Hall of Fame, was the organization behind the creation of its affiliated museum in Cleveland, made the announcement in a brief statement released Saturday. Jan Wenner has been removed from the board of directors of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Foundation. The statement said, the president and CEO of the foundation declined to comment further when reached by phone, but the dismissal of Jan Wenner comes after an interview with The Times published Friday and timed to the publication of his new book called The Masters, which collects his decades of interviews with rock legends such as Bob Dylan, Mick Jagger, John Lennon, Bruce Springsteen, and Bono, all of them white, all of them male. In the interview, David Marchese of the Times asked Mr. Wenner why the book included no women or people of color. Regarding women, Mr. Wenner said, just none of them were as articulate enough on this intellectual level, and remarked that Joni Mitchell, quote, was not a philosopher of rock and roll. His answer about artists of color was less direct. Of black artists, you know, Stevie Wonder, genius, right? I suppose when you use a word as broad as masters, the fault is using that word. Maybe Marvin Gaye or Curtis Mayfield? I mean, they just didn't articulate at that level.
So my brilliant writer, journalist friend, Ann O'Neill, summed this up for me the best in an open letter to Jan. And she said, dear Jan, Linda Ronstadt, Joni Mitchell, Katie Lang, Aretha Franklin, Janis Joplin, Tina Turner, et cetera, and I agree that on an intellectual level, you are not tall enough for any of us.
That is excelente.
That sums it up. First, it's a repugnant view. It's at odds with history. It is in line with Rolling Stone, which for decades featured male white stars over anybody else. He always had that predilection. But then to think that a man who has spent decades in publishing, whose Rolling Stone had a huge mess just a few years ago, listening, not checking their journalism, would be so stupid as to say this part aloud in an interview.
Well, I agree with you, but I also I would also add that from a publishing front, of why that was not
killed his book.
Why it was not addressed by an editor that said, hey, by the way,
good point.
All white guys.
Yeah, they didn't have very many women on the staff. I guess they didn't have very many people of color on the staff. And in fact, none until the 90s. And
sorry.
It's too bad, because I did regard Rolling Stone as a very interesting magazine to read. And it puts a paw over everything they've published now, which is probably unfair to the journalists that have worked there. But it's a shame. I think it's the it's the the beginning of the end was their University of Virginia coverage about the rapes, which was not fact checked and turned out to be a disaster. But after that, this is probably going to be the other nail in the coffin.
I mean, that set women's rights back too. It was a case of a woman, not identified, crying false rape. It just gave credence to the idea that it's all made up. He's just been a disaster for women all of his life, and to not recognize musicians of color is just extraordinary.
I think, but again, in where we are in our place and time, for someone, an editor, a publisher, Little Brown in this case, this is the cover of the book. The Masters, Conversations with Bono, Dylan, Garcia, Jagger, Lennon, Springsteen, and Townsend. How do you, in 2023, not at some meeting say, hey...
Shouldn't we have a woman in there?
No, women, what's the diversity makeup? I mean, what? Shouldn't we have some diversity? We have a DEI department. Did anyone look at this first?
Are they allowed anymore? Did the Supreme Court dump all?
No, no, no. Private businesses can have diversity employment people.
All right. Well, that'll bring us to the end of our conversation. My thanks to all of you, and especially to Mike, Rosemary, and Fran. You're all wonderful. We'll be back right after this.